Welcome to the First Things podcast. In this episode, we'll reflect on the life and accomplishments of Phyllis Schlafly, the anti-feminist icon who died early this week. We'll ask whether social conservatism would be better off if Mrs. Schlafly and her army of housewives hadn't succeeded in killing the Equal Rights Amendment. Then, the new academic year is upon us, and you won't believe what they're teaching the kids in freshman orientation these days. Do you know the difference between a microaggression and a micro-invalidation? We'll bring you up to speed. I'm joined on this episode by First Things editor Rusty Reno and senior editor Mark Bauerlein, and Midge Dechter is our special guest in the first half. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening. On Monday this week, Phyllis Schlafly died at age 92. A prim and housewifely woman from St. Louis, Missouri, Schlafly had worked as a model and as a ballistics gunner at a munitions factory while putting herself through college during World War II. She ran for Congress on the Republican ticket twice, both times unsuccessfully. She self-published a book that is credited with delivering the 1964 Republican nomination to Goldwater. She married and had six children. She earned a master's and a JD from Radcliffe and Washington University, respectively. She organized the grassroots movement that killed the Equal Rights Amendment, and she was a regular in media and on the lecture circuit almost until she died. She often began her public appearances by saying, "I'd like to thank my husband, Fred, for allowing me to come here this evening." She said that this opening irritates women's libbers more than anything else. I'm joined now by Rusty Reno and Mark Bauerlein, and by longtime friend of the magazine and all-around legendary journalist and editor, Midge Dechter. Midge has graciously stopped by our office to help us assess the career and legacy of Mrs. Schlafly. Midge, welcome.
Midge, did Norman let you come today?
Oh, yes, I'm grateful to him for my appearance here.
Okay, so why don't we start with the Equal Rights Amendment? Schlafly's defeat of it was a very unlikely feat. Mathematically, the ERA was almost a done deal when she began her intervention in 1972. 30 of the 38 states that were needed had already ratified it. Most Republicans supported it, including Ronald Reagan. And the argument Schlafly was making was a tough one. She said many years later, "Who wants to be against equal rights? It's a hard issue to sell." But she sold it. So thoughts about the principles at stake there, about the magnitude of her accomplishment and the legacy of it?
Well, I suppose I should begin, since I'm the anti-women's liber in the room. I first discovered Phyllis Schlafly on television. She held a meeting somewhere, and suddenly I saw a group of well-heeled, well-dressed, young, handsome women filing into a hotel room where they were going to attack the feminist movement. The Equal Rights Amendment part of this, I think, was more symbolic than anything else. Women had equal rights, so the idea that this amendment was frivolous to begin with, and so her opposition to it was significant for that reason. It was something on which she could pin a program, although I don't think in itself it was that important.
What was the program that she was opposed to?
The women's movement was becoming very noisy, which was ridiculous. It was ridiculous, and yet it was taking hold, the women's movement, because if you go to a group of people, especially somehow well-heeled, privileged people, and say you are victims, you're going to take hold. The women's movement started around somewhere in the 60s, where all good movements started, and it said absurd things. Things like American women are oppressed, and they're driven to do housework all day. And Betty Friedan, who was the woman who really was the spokeswoman for this movement for a long time, wrote a book in which she said suburban housewives were slaves. They were slaves to the household while their husbands went off to the city to do romantic and exciting things. And of course, if you say to a group of privileged and well-off people, you are victims and you poor things, you're going to get a huge response. And so she did, and nowhere more than in the middle and upper middle class, and nowhere more than among college-educated and professional women. And this seemed to me very bad news, because you were taking our daughters and making them unhappy. And suddenly, I discovered, probably very late in her career as an anti-feminist, there was this handsome woman from the Middle West organizing against this movement. So I was deeply interested in her from the beginning, though it took me, something like 15 to 20 years before I ever met her, actually, in the flesh.
Where did you meet her?
At some conference. I'm not sure I remember exactly which one. Our relations were cordial and distant.
And that was after 82 when the ERA bit the dust. Because I remember that was I was a college student, and I remember it really reverberated as a shocking defeat that this would fail. Because I think that sort of all the right-thinking people just assumed that this was what the virtuous, how could we fail to do the virtuous thing as a nation?
Yes, of course.
And the fact that, so I knew her name solely through this, so the liberal campus where I attended college, you didn't hear about any conservative activists except Phyllis Schlafly.
Well,
because
okay.
of her success in this anti-feminism.
Okay. Right. And of course, the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment is what kept the feminist movement alive. That's the irony.
It seems to me one of the things the defeat of the ERA did was to make feminists within the Republican Party very dissatisfied with it, and to drive them over to the Democrats, which then tends to polarize women's issues along party lines and allows Democrats to succeed electorally with radicalizing gambits like the war on women. That's a slogan that has always seemed to me so over the top. But when one party is the party of women and the other is not, it just doesn't matter.
Well, I just wanted to say on that when the ERA failed, it was the first example that I heard of the kind of state-level boycotts that we're seeing more and more. I was a graduate student. The Modern Language Association determined when that failed that it would not run its annual convention in any state that had not passed the ERA. Not long ago, they decided to go ahead and drop that. But when I was going to the convention back in the 80s and 90s, it was still in place.
Well, it seems to me that the defeat of the ERA is what kept the angry end of the feminist movement alive. It's not the only thing, but it certainly helped.
Yeah, it's interesting and painful to think what actually was gained and not gained for social conservatives by the defeat of the ERA. So Schlafly had warned that if the ERA were to pass, here are some things that would ensue. Quote, government-funded abortions, homosexual school teachers, women forced into military combat, and men refusing to support their wives. Most of these things, or all of these things, have come to pass anyway by judicial or legislative means. For the Supreme Court, there's nothing that the ERA was supposed to do that the Equal Protection Clause can't be made to do. So Justice Ginsburg said in the mid-90s, quote, "There is no practical difference between what has evolved and the ERA." So that seems a bit of a dispiriting commentary on Phyllis Schlafly's greatest achievement.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that, like I said, as a I was a kind of a soft lefty at the time in college at a very homogeneous environment. But that penetrated into that closed world, that defeat, and I think that it had a lot to do with her success. Really was a key element in the rise of social conservatism as a confident political force. Now, maybe 30 years later, we can say, but we don't know what bad things were prevented by delaying what she foresaw. You know, one doesn't always measure political success by sometimes just delaying the bad things is worth the effort. We've grown apart more and more. We see this in our political climate right now. And part of what Schlafly did is she empowered women who did not want to participate in the excesses of feminism. She empowered them to go on and unite and create a subculture or a counterculture. So I think someone like Schlafly created space where upper middle class Americans who didn't want to participate in this could opt out.
One way in which Phyllis Schlafly made her mark was with endorsements. She was all in for Goldwater, very decisively for his prospects in the 1964 primary. In 2015, she endorsed Trump. Her final book, released the day after her death, is titled The Conservative Case for Trump. Her Trump support split the leadership of the Eagle Forum, which is her grassroots activist organization. Half the board members agreed with her endorsement. The other half preferred Ted Cruz, who, with his social conservatism, might seem the more obvious choice for the Eagle Forum. Apparently, it got pretty ugly with rogue board meetings and attempted coups and so on.
Sounds like the First Things editorial.
It does. It does. What should we make of Schlafly's support for Trump? Is this principled, opportunistic, good move, bad move?
She wanted to win.
Yeah.
And she believed that he was the winner. I'm sure that's why. And since she believed he was the winner, she was a very, very shrewd lady. She was a practical person, and she was a political person, which was very important. The women's movement was not political in the sense that she was. It was a lot of people claiming outrageous things, claiming oppression. And because the women's movement wasn't a political movement in that sense, and Phyllis Schlafly was a political animal, and so she outsmarted them.
Also, it could be the case that, you know, she came in as a rogue commando operative, bucking what the conservative establishment wanted with Goldwater, and she went out as a rogue commando operative, bucking what the conservative establishment wanted with Trump. So, and you know, the other folks on the board of the Eagle Forum, a lot of them, some of whom were her own children, didn't necessarily have that as their formative experience.
Right. Her Trump support seems totally consistent with her longstanding opposition to what she called the secret kingmakers in the party, who once were the Rockefeller Republicans, now are the establishment and donor class. So she said in an interview, "Trump is the only hope to defeat the kingmakers." She also said he's the one the grassroots want. So there's this very strong anti-establishment, populist, slightly conspiratorial theme that she sounded, I think, very consistently throughout her career. So that seems very formative for her in a way that you know, for people who came of age politically in, say, the 80s, right, that's not necessarily their formation. Also, to what Midge was saying, it does seem that so much of Schlafly's contribution took the form of tutoring women in how they can begin to be political. You know, how do you interact efficaciously with your congressman? You write to him with these talking points, and when you get a reply, you send him a thank you note. If you're going to a protest, you wear the right colors for TV. You smile. So just very practical and very self-aware advice about how to begin to be political. Mark, you I believe, had your own close encounter with Phyllis Schlafly. Why don't you tell us about that?
This was on an entirely different subject. I spent an hour on her radio show, the Eagle Forum Network, oh gosh, 4 or 5 years ago, on a completely different subject. She got very interested in reading and got involved in the so-called reading wars, as they were called in educational circles, way back in the 70s and 80s.
Whole language versus
phonics.
Phonics, okay,
phonics,
wow.
Right. And they were fierce. Educators know, actually, they understand a lot is at stake with what you do with 8, 9, and 10-year-olds. And she got involved in that because she was a phonics person and felt that the whole language was kind of soft and fuzzy, too child-centered, too progressivist in its overtones. And so I'd written some things about the decline of the reading life among teenagers. And so we spent an hour. And I have to say what I sensed underneath the discussion was just a genuine, sincere concern for the education of young minds, that there was you couldn't read anything ideological in her position. It really was about cultivating the intellectual faculties in young people at young ages. And she was you know, she's in her late 80s at the time, but she was right up on the issues and very sharp. And it was a great hour.
Great hour with a great lady.
Indeed.
I want to conclude with an anecdote that I think should get all persons of goodwill on Mrs. Schlafly's side. In 2008, she was awarded an honorary degree by her undergraduate and law school alma mater, Washington University in St. Louis. There ensued much complaining. This was an anti-intellectual and anti-feminist figure who was receiving this honor. So during the ceremony, one-third of the graduating students and faculty silently stood and turned their backs in protest. Schlafly said afterward, "I'm not sure they're mature enough to graduate." Which makes a nice segue into our next segment. Anyway, Midge, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks a lot.
It's that time of year again, when the youngsters go off to college, move into their dorm rooms, and attend freshman orientation. Pardon me, first-year student orientation. The other term is a microaggression. This year, first-year student orientation, though I wonder whether orientation isn't a microaggression too. Oh well. First-year student orientation on many campuses will involve instruction by diversity officers.
Instruction, isn't that a microaggression?
Possibly. We should parse that. Instruction by diversity officers in the finer points of microaggression and trigger warnings and safe spaces and all the rest. An article in the New York Times this week, which we've linked at firstthings.com, include some tips, courtesy of the chief diversity officer at a private liberal arts college in Massachusetts. Don't ask an Asian student to help you with your math homework. Don't ask a black classmate whether he plays basketball. Don't address mixed company as "you guys." The article quotes a student present at this orientation session who has often endured microaggressive compliments such as, "You're a really good student for a Hispanic." But she also recognizes her own culpability for her frequent use of the phrase, "you guys." Quote, "This helped me see that I'm a microaggressor too." It's easy to scoff at this, but Well, I don't know. Is there a but? Rusty and Mark, do the extreme levels of sensitivity now encouraged on college campuses deserve our understanding or our utter contempt?
Well, not contempt. I don't think contempt is probably the right response. Sympathy for the students, I think, is more appropriate. Because when I read that article, I thought, wow, talk about raising the blood pressure in the room. Every encounter you have with another human being is fraught with the dangers of injustice. And so not only are these kids, you know, being fed into the meritocratic machine in this ruthless scramble for professional success, but they have to self-monitor at every turn. And I just think that this contributes to this feeling that you're stuck in a vice, young people stuck in a vice that's getting ever tighter.
You know, the self-monitoring here is also impossible. Because microaggressions are defined as largely unintentional. You don't know what you are doing. You have no malicious intent whatsoever. In fact, you're often trying to be kind, to be friendly, and you are still guilty. When we do this micro level of human motive, it's so invasive. You know, they're plunging deep down into the recesses of your unconscious. And so you don't know. I mean, and what is the response to this? It's a form of pressure. And then you shut down. These are just lesser versions that you come up with if you're a student, lesser versions of Winston Smith at the end of 1984, in which he just has kind of gone blank. He's pulled down his full humanity. He's been under the surveillance. And the students, I see this look, and I don't want to overdo it. I'm saying, you know, a much lower level, but the same kind of thing that I see come over students' faces whenever race or gender identity or politics actually come up in a classroom. The screen goes down, the eyes go blank. They don't want to give you anything. And it only takes one case for something to be used against them because the stakes are so high in these high achiever environments. It only takes one time for them to learn.
Right.
They never want that to happen ever again. And, you know, in the Times article, you have things that the micro examination even comes down to the level of certain beliefs that you might have openly. For example, in that article is, I believe that everyone, if he works hard, if given a fair shot, can succeed in this country. That is what's called a micro invalidation. There's a term for it.
So these kids are in a vice. If they make any assumptions about race, they're committing a microaggression. If they don't make an assumption about race, they're creating a micro invalidation. So they're stuck. What came to my mind was Martin Luther in his a moment of feeling trapped by the judgment of God and unable to escape an examination of his conscience from the judgment of his own sinfulness. And that really was the kind of crisis of faith for him, a kind of Pelagian sense that we can't escape from our own sinfulness. And then, of course, he has this realization that God's mercy, God's love in Christ overcomes our sinfulness. So we're justified by our faith and not by our works. And what's interesting is in this particular legalistic system, there is really no escape. There's no forgiveness. It really is this kind of very intense system of moral condemnation with no word of grace.
Here's the question. Who are going to be the supervisors?
What do you mean, who are going to be the supervisors?
Who are the custodians of virtue and vice here? We don't have God in place here. We have chief diversity officers. Who are the human? I mean, this is a question that always comes up from Robespierre forward. Who are the ones who are going to supervise all of this? What human beings qualify? Which ones have the wisdom, the knowledge, the discernment, the judgment, the sensitivity to be able to look at human beings, reach down deep into their minds? Who's going to manage the relations? This is always the question that these regimes come up against.
Right, and fail to answer in a satisfactory way, certainly.
There is no satisfactory answer.
So that with that analogy, the Robespierre analogy, which I think is apt, you would think, Mark, then that this is all going to come to grief at some point.
You know, I always think that these systems or the political correctness is going to come to grief. We've had political correctness now in the public eye for 30 years. It has been shown to be illiberal and often dehumanizing and constraining, but political correctness is worse today than it has ever been in my lifetime. And one just thinks if there are managerial adjustments when you do see things go wrong, but the ocean liner just keeps moving forward and forward.
We've talked quite a bit about microaggressions. We haven't really talked about triggers. That's another important term that's being thrown around on these campuses. And so triggers are a bit different from microaggressions. They're artifacts that are associated with an individual student's private trauma, which may be present in course materials and so cause the student great distress, so that the student requires a safe space. So a student who once suffered sexual assault might be triggered by a scene in Ovid. That's sort of a classic example. Or the triggering artifact might be something completely idiosyncratic that no one else would anticipate would have any association with a person's trauma. Mark, you still have a foot in academia. Rusty, you haven't taught on campus in a few years.
I'm a recovering academic.
Recovering academic. Has either of you ever had to deal with a student who claimed to be triggered or microaggressed against in your class?
Certainly not me. I taught at a Catholic university in the Midwest, Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and I think the kinds of kids who came to that school were not socialized, really, I think you have to be socialized to be anxious about these kinds of things. It's not natural. I think the more normal patterns of socialization actually prepare you to endure things that are difficult. Instead, we live in a moment culturally where certainly among upper middle class parents are so eager that their children never endure any trauma of any sort that young people are actually trained to protest when they're under duress.
Over the years, I've had a couple of black students approach me afterward or by email. And it was all about one thing. I teach American literature. You've got the narrative of Frederick Douglass. You have Huck Finn. You've got Du Bois. And you've got the N-word. That's it, the N-word. It's the word on college campuses that is the most fraught, I think. And I simply say, oh yeah, I know, it's awful, of course. But it's part of the history, it's part of the literature, and we have to be able to frame it as part of our object of study. And so I know it's upsetting, but I can't just censor that out. When we're going through the text.
And how did they respond?
Well, I mean, I'll read.
The students, so I mean, when you explain it to them, they would say, "Okay, I get it."
Yeah. They, they're not happy with that response, but they accept that response, and I think they understand that it's not me they're unhappy with; it's the historical record. But I don't back down. on the necessity of not censoring that word out. That's it.
It's great that you've been able to do that. And I think that one of the exasperating things about the concept of triggering is that it disallows that kind of conversation that you had with your students that got them to see the use of encountering these terms and framing them as objects of study, as givens of the historical record. The concept of triggering disallows any examination of the triggering artifact, because the whole idea about triggers is that they replay a person's trauma. And so there is no conversation that can be had about them. They simply must be deleted from the person's experience.
These are pathological reactions. And what the universities advise in their trigger warnings is, if you've been triggered, leave the room. Go to the bathroom, go to a drinking fountain. You must withdraw. You must separate yourself.
Well, that's about to my point that from time immemorial, whether it's Epictetus and Stoicism or Aristotle and the life of virtue, or for that matter, the Book of Proverbs, one has to prepare oneself for adversity. And we just live in a time when people are told that it is unjust to suffer any adversity. So therefore, you don't need to prepare for it. Instead, you need to appeal to authorities to eliminate the adversity. So I think that we see this. Also, another feature here, most students, the majority of students, the super majority of students, it's really not a problem. And what we're doing is we're organizing our educational culture around outliers. And that is what I think is characteristic of our society right now as a whole. I mean, the transgender bathroom kerfuffle is really, I think, at a deep level about the sort of bizarre way our society is organizing itself around outliers. And same thing is true if Mark were to design a syllabus around the off chance that something might disturb one or two students. It is kind of crazy approach to any society to organize itself around outliers.
It's a crazy approach, but these outliers are very savvy. They know exactly what they're doing. I have taught a class in which a student claimed to have been triggered by something in the course material. This was a year ago when I was teaching a fiction workshop at WashU. And the whole experience was very instructive for me, because what struck me about the student who was claiming triggering was that she was not fragile. She was very spunky, very politically aware, extremely disputatious, the most argumentative student I have ever had in a class. She was constantly picking fights about politics during class, which was very annoying to me, though I found her endearing in a lot of ways. But she knew exactly the power that her claim of triggering had. You know, she understood that when you claim to have been traumatized by something, you become a very celebrated kind of victim, and that status is very usefully weaponized. And during her triggering episode, she pivoted very smoothly to an argument about public norms around certain sensitive artifacts, and she tried to extrapolate from her private experience sort of to what should be going on in this classroom or any classroom. And it struck me that she, as usual with her, she wasn't looking for a safe space, as she was claiming at that juncture. She was looking for a fight, and power to her. But this is what I always think about, say, the snowflakes who were videotaped on old campus at Yale, which is the other place where I've taught, screaming about Halloween costumes. They're insisting that they need a safe space, but I think what they want is to be at the center of a controversy that they know very well how to manipulate, because they know exactly the style of victimhood that they should perform. And I think that if they actually were fragile, as they claim to be, this is the last thing they would want, to be at the center of a public controversy. So I don't, I mean, I think I disagree with you, Rusty, a little bit in that I don't actually think that their distress is genuine. I mean, people can always work themselves into hysterics when they want to. And the fact is they want to because it gives them power.
Oh, good, good. Well, maybe you're right about that. I do think that, you know, I've certainly seen in educational environments, you know, adolescents, especially males that want to be flamboyantly gay, and I've seen that in action as a way of controlling social interactions, because it's a way of forcing everyone to respond to you on your terms, and you know you're it is a very obvious way of controlling other people's controlling the atmosphere of the room, controlling the tone of the conversation, and so on. So I think you're right about that. But maybe the more relevant thing to save my position is that people are socialized to believe that we shouldn't make anyone feel uncomfortable. And that's what creates the general atmosphere in which these kinds of power plays can go unchallenged.
The University of Chicago has sent a highly publicized welcome letter to incoming freshmen, and yes, I said freshmen. It reads in part, "Our commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." Thoughts? Is this the right way to go?
It has turned out to be a very successful marketing strategy for the University of Chicago, by the way. I mean, I've traveled around the last few weeks, and this has come up in conversations with parents. So people will say, worry about, well, where can you send your kids if they're not subjected to this kind of ideological, stultifying ideological environment? And then University of Chicago comes up right away because of the fact that the president had the testicular fortitude to actually say out loud what almost everyone in academia actually believes.
I think it was a dean, not the president. But I had the same response. I mean, I was gratified by the message and the principle involved, but also this seemed to me to distinguish the University of Chicago. And if you can distinguish yourself in the competitive environment of college admissions, if this is going to bring some students who otherwise might have attended Wash U or Northwestern, some of the schools that Chicago compares itself to, then, you know, more power to you, especially if it's done on the right principles. So I think this has been great. It's been great for Chicago, and I would not be surprised if a lot of students whose parents are dismayed by all of the hypersensitivities elsewhere.
Well, I know
so
alums.
Apply to Chicago.
Alums are getting more concerned now. I think there's been a slight decline in alumni contributions last year to these high-flying elite universities because of concern about I'm over here kind of listserv conversations that float through my email where, you know, people my age, graduates, are saying, what is going on? So there is a certain backlash here that may be healthy.
The Chicago letter plumps for academic freedom. And I just wonder whether, from a conservative perspective, these principles of academic freedom and free speech are absolutes that we should be asserting and defending in these debates.
I think academic freedom has an important role to play, but it's limited. And I think I would rather see the pushback in the service of cultivating the life of the mind so that, I mean, academic freedoms, you say that, well, we have to have use the Millian image of a marketplace of ideas. You have to have an open debate so that you can maybe make some progress towards the truth. So the freedom is for the sake of truth seeking. It is not an end in itself.
I would say a lot of the arguments are free speech arguments made by a lot of people, off-campus commentators and the academic freedom. I think it's a mistake to try to raise it up to that level of principle. I would much prefer to hear the talk be about maturity, adulthood, grown-ups.
Right.
This is a place where we're leaving high school.
Also being a citizen in a pluralistic society where you
which
have to
learn.
Which
requires a bit of a thick skin.
Yeah.
You know, that's the price of an open society.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to learn that. And so I would see it more in terms of formation.
Mm-hmm.
Education as a process of formation, of character and taste to go along with the free speech issues.
I'm less interested in defending university campuses as zones of absolutely free speech and more interested in defending them as spaces in which 18-year-olds are forced to read dead white men and learn to compose coherent essays.
That'd be nice.
That seems to me the crying need.
So, do I have to be dead before I'm read by college students?
That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Mark Bauerlein. Special thanks to Midge Dechter, who's forgotten more about women's lib than I will ever know. And thank you, listeners.
Did she see you, your circle, as maybe too much part of a Republican establishment?
No, we were the neocons, and we were not beloved by the right wing. In fact, we were not beloved by anybody for a long time, I think you could say, because we had, there was a record of terrible things we'd said from the left side, and then there was another record of terrible things said from the right side. So we were never quite acceptable.
Never in Reagan's administration?
Well, Reagan's administration was a happy moment.